Leaderless, though they missed their leader, but they were taken in charge by Podarces, a true sprig of Ares, son of Iphicus Philicides, the master of many flocks, own brother to proud Protesilaus, but younger. Protesilaus was older and a better man of war, but the men did not want a leader, though they missed the good man they had lost. He had 40 black ships in his squadron. There were the men from Pheri beside the Boebean Lake, from Boibe and Glaphyri, and well-built Iolcus. These 11 ships were led by Eumelos, the beloved son of Adametos, whose mother was the noble Alcestis, most lovely of Peleus's daughters. There were the men from Methone and Thormatia, from Melibea and rugged Olizon, led by the master bowman Philoctetes in 7 ships. 50 oarsmen were in each ship, all expert with the bow. But Philoctetes lay in an island, suffering dreadful pain in sacred Lemnos, where they had left him behind, tormented by a horrible wound from a poisonous serpent. There he lay in suffering. But the Argives were soon to remember my lord Philoctetes. Nor were his men leaderless, though they missed their leader, but they were taken in charge by Medon, the bastard son of Oileus and Rhene. There were the men from Trica and Ithome amid the hills, and from Icalia, the city of Eurytos. These were led by the 2 sons of Asclepius, Podalirius and Macedon, good physicians both. Their squadron was 30 ships. There were the men from Omenius, and from the fountain Hipparia, and from Asterion and the white crags of Titanos, led by Eurypylus, the fine son of Euaemon. 40 black ships were his. There were the men from Argissa and Gertone, from Orthi and Elone and white Oloosson. These were led by Polypetes, that trusty fighter, the son of Pirithoas, whose father was Zeus immortal. His mother, Hippodamia, conceived him on that very day when Pirithoas punished the shaggy monsters, when he drove them out of Bilion, away to the Ithryces. He was not alone. With him was Leontios, that true sprig of Ares, the son of proud Coronus Caeneades, and they had 40 black ships. Gunios from Siphos had 40 black ships. He led the Enneines and the trusty Pereboi, who came from cold, stormy Dodona, and from the farms beside the delightful Titaresios, which pours his flood of water into Peneos. The water does not mix with the silver eddies of Peneos, but runs above it like olive oil, for it is a rivulet of Styx, that awful oath. The Magnesians were led by Prothoas, the runner, son of Teuthrodon. Those from the banks of Peneos and from leaf-shaking Pelion, 40 black ships were with him. These were the leaders and the lords of the Danaans, but which was the best of these, best among horses and best among men in all the Achaean host? Horses the best by far were those of Phrytiades, which Eumelos drove, swift on the foot as birds, of one coat and one age, level as a builder's rule across their backs. Apollo Silverbow bred them in Perea, mares both, bringing with them the terror of war. Of men, the best by far was Telamonian Aeus, while Achilles was angry, for Achilles was first of all, and so were the horses which drew the admirable Achilles. But he lay idle beside the ships, enraged against my lord King Agamemnon, and his people on the seashore amused themselves with quoits and javelins and arrows. Their horses stood each near his own car, chomping clover and marsh-grown parsley, while the cars were in the huts of their masters, well wrapped up. And the masters wandered about the camp, longing for their leader out of the fight. So all this host went sweeping over the earth like a conflagration. The ground groaned under their tramp, as when Zeus' thunderer in wrath lashes the ground round about Typhoeus, where he lies in Arima. So under their trampling feet the ground loudly groaned, and quickly they passed over the plain. But a messenger came to the Trojans, Stormfoot Iris, with a lamentable message from Zeus Almighty. They were in conclave by the city gates, all assembled together, both young and old. Iris came near and spoke to Priam with the voice of his son Polites, who was the Trojan scout. He used to post himself on the barrow of old Aeacides to watch when the enemy was coming out, and then run back at full speed. Iris made her voice like his and said to Priam, "Sir, you go on talking forever as if we were still at peace, but here is a war upon us, overwhelming war. Indeed, I have been in many battles already, but such a host and so many men I never did see. Like the leaves of the forest or the sands of the seashore, they are coming over the plain to attack our city. Hector, you are the man I want, and this is what you must do. We have many allies about the walls from all parts of the country, and each has his own language. Let each man take charge of his countrymen and tell them where to go." Hector at once dismissed the assembly, and they hurried to arms. All the gates were opened, the men poured out, horse and foot. There was a great uproar. Now there is a steep hillock away in the plain, with a clear space all round, which men call Bataia, but the immortals call it Dancing Myrine's Barrow. There the Trojans and allies mustered their ranks. Hector Priamides commanded the Trojans. He had under his own hand much the larger division of armed spearmen and the best men. The Dardanians were led by Aeneas, son of Anchises. His mother was the divine Aphrodite, who lay with Anchises on the foothills of Mount Ida, goddess with mortal man. With Aeneas were the two sons of Antenor, Archilochus and Acamas, complete warriors both. Those who came from Zelea, under the lowest foot of Ida, and drank the water of the Aesepus, wealthy men and Trojans, were led by Lycon's son Pandarus, who received his bow from Apollo himself. Those who came from Adrastia, in the land of Apisos, from Pityia and the steep hill of Tyria, were led by Adrastos and Amphios in his linen corselet, two sons of Percosian Merops. He understood divination beyond all others, and he forbade his sons to go to war. But they disobeyed him, since the fate of black death drove them on. Those who came from Percote and Praction, from Sestos and Abydos and sunny Arisbe, were led by Aesius, Hyrtacus' son. He came from Arisbe beside the river Selleus, driving great chestnut horses. Hippothous led the bands of Pelasgian spearmen, those who were settled on the rich soil of Larissa. Hippothous and Peleus, that true sprig of Ares, the two sons of the Pelasgian Lethos, Teutamus's son. The Thracians were led by Acamas and Pyroas, all those enclosed by the strong-flowing Hellespont. Euphemus was the leader of the Siconian spearmen. He was the son of Prince Trisinosiades. Pyracmes led the Paeonians with curving bows. He brought them a long way out of Amydon, from the broad river Axios, from Axios, the finest water that runs over the earth. The Paphlagonians were led by hairy Pylaemenes from the Enetae, where the wild she-mules are found. They were settled at Sitoras and Sisamos, about the river Parthenios, at Chroma and Aegialos and lofty Erythinoi. The Alizones were led by Odios and Epistrophos from Alibi, far away where silver has its birth. The Mycians were led by Chromes and Eunomus, the diviner of birds, but his birds did not save him from black death, for he was brought low by the hand of Achilles at the river, when Achilles despoiled other Trojans too. Phorcys led the Frisians and noble Ascanius from distant Ascania. They were eager to join in the fray. The Meonians were led by Methles and Antiphos, two sons of Telemenes, born beside the Gygaean lake. They brought the Meonians from their birthplace under Tmoas. Nastes again led the Carians, men of barbarous speech, who came from Miletos and the leafy mountain of Phthira, from the streams of Myandros and the high peaks of Mycale. Amphimachus and Nastes were their leaders, Nastes and Amphimachus, the fine sons of Nomaion. One came to the war all over gold, like a girl, poor fool. It did not save him from cruel death, but he was brought low by the hands of Achilles at the river, and prudent Achilles carried off the gold. Sarpedon and the admirable Glaucus led the Lycians out of far-off Lycia from the eddying Xanthos. Book 3. How Menelaus and Alexandros fought a duel together, and what came of it. And now the two armies advanced, each under its own leaders. The Trojans raised a loud din and clamor like a huge flock of birds, so you may hear cranes honking out of the sky before a storm of rain as they fly with a great noise towards the ocean stream, bringing death and destruction to the Pygmy men, and in the early morning they open their flight. But the Achaeans marched in silence, breathing fury shoulder to shoulder with grim determination. The dust rose in clouds under their feet as they marched a pace over the plain, as thick as the mist which a south wind spreads over the mountains. Shepherds hate it. The robber likes it better than night. A man can see a stone's throw and no farther. No sooner had the two armies come near than a champion swept out of the Trojan ranks, the noble prince Alexandros. That was the name of Paris, who had carried off Helen. A leopard skin hung over his shoulders with bow and sword. He took his two sharp spears and challenged all comers to fight him man to man. So he strode out with long steps. Menelaus saw him with joy, as a lion spies a victim when he is hungry and finds a horned stag or a wild goat. Greedily he devours his prey, even if dogs and lusty lads set upon him. So Menelaus was glad when he set eyes on Alexandros, for he thought he was sure to punish the traitor. At once he leapt down from his chariot in his armor. But as soon as Alexandros saw him come out in front, his heart sank, and he slunk back into the ranks to save himself. He might have been someone walking through the woods who suddenly sees a snake and jumps back, all of a tremble, pale with fear. So Alexandros jumped back, and so he slunk into safety. Then Hector rated him with scorn. "Damn you, Paris, you handsome woman hunter, you seducer. I wish you had never been born. I wish you had died unwedded. Yes, I wish that. And it would have been much better than to be a public pest, a thing of contempt. What guffaws there must be over there. They thought you a prime champion because you are good-looking, but there's no pluck in you, no fight. Were you like this when you got your fine company and set sail over the sea and traveled in foreign lands and brought home a handsome woman? She was to marry into a warlike nation. She was to be the ruin of your father and all his people, a joy to your enemies, a disgrace to yourself. So you would not stand up to Menelaus? You ought to find out what sort of fellow he is whose wife you are keeping. There would be little use then for your harp and the gifts of Aphrodite, your fine hair and good looks when you lie in the dust. Well, the Trojans are all cowards, or you would have had a coat of stone long ago for the evil you have done. Alexandros replied, "That is true enough, Hector, that is true enough. Your heart is always as hard as steel. Like a shipwright's axe when he slices off a spar from a tree with all the strength of a man. A hard heart indeed. Don't taunt me with Aphrodite's adorable gifts. You can't throw away a god's gifts, offered unasked, which none could win by wishing. Very well now, if you want me to fight, make both armies sit down on the ground and put me between them with Menelaus to fight for Helen and all her wealth. Whichever proves the better man, let him take both wealth and woman home with him. Then let both sides swear friendship and peace, you to stay in Troy, they to go back to Argos, where there are plenty of fine women." Hector was well satisfied with this. He went out between the ranks, holding his spear by the middle, and waved back his men. The Trojans sat down in order. But the Achaeans at first went on shooting at him and throwing javelins and stones, until King Agamemnon shouted in a loud voice, "Stop it, men! Don't shoot, men! Hector wants to say something!" They stopped at once and fell silent. And then Hector spoke out between the armies. "Hear me, Trojans, and you men of Achaea, while I give you a message from Alexandros, who was the cause of our war. He asks that both Trojans and Achaeans lay down their arms on the ground, and let Menelaus and himself fight a duel for Helen and all her wealth. Whichever proves the better man shall take both wealth and woman home with him. Then let both sides swear friendship and peace." All heard this in silence. Then Menelaus cried out, "Hear me also. This touches me most nearly, but my mind is that Achaeans and Trojans should now be reconciled. You have suffered enough for this quarrel of mine which Alexandros began. Whichever of us is fated to die, let him die, and let the others make friends forthwith. You bring two lambs, a white ram and a black ewe, for earth and sun, and we will bring another ram for Zeus. Call his grace King Priam, that he may take the oath himself, for his sons are overbearing and faithless, and we do not wish anything done to violate the solemn oath. Young men's minds are always aflutter, but when an old man is there, he looks both before and behind to see that the best is done for both sides." Achaeans and Trojans were all glad that there was some hope to end that lamentable war. They arranged their chariots in order, the men got out and put off their armor, laying it all upon the ground close together, and leaving a small space between the armies. Hector sent two heralds into the city to fetch the animals and to call Priam. King Agamemnon sent Talthybius to the camp with orders to bring the ram. Meanwhile, Iris had her own errand to Helen. She took the likeness of her good sister Laodice, the most beautiful of Priam's daughters, the wife of Helicaon Antenor's son. Iris found Helen in her room. She was weaving a great web of purple stuff, double size, and embroidering in it pictures of the battles of that war, which two armies were waging for her sake. Iris came up to Helen and said, "Come along, my love, and see a wonderful sight. They were all fighting in the plain like fury, and now, all of a sudden, they are sitting down. Not a sound to be heard, no more battle, all leaning upon their shields and their spears stuck in the ground. But Alexandros and Menelaus are going to fight for you, and you are to be the wife of the winner." These words pierced Helen to the heart. She longed for her husband of the old days, for home and family. At once she threw a white veil over her and left the house quickly with tears running down her cheeks. Two maids were in attendance, Aethra and Clymene, with her great eyes. They made their way to the Scaean gates. Priam was sitting over the gatehouse in a group of the city elders, Panthous and Thymetes, Lampus and Clytius, Hicataeon, once well known in the field, and two men of tried wisdom, Eucalagon and Antenor. These were old men, long past their fighting days, but excellent speakers. There they all sat on the tower, chirruping in their thin old voices, like so many crickets on a tree. As they saw Helen coming up, they whispered to one another in plain words, "No wonder Achaeans and Trojans have been fighting all these years for such a woman. I do declare she is like some divine creature come down from heaven. Well, all the same, I wish you would sail away and not stay here to be the ruin of us and our children." But Priam called Helen to his side. "Come here, my dear child, and sit by me, to see your husband that was, and your family and friends. I don't blame you, my dear, I blame only the gods for sending that host of enemies to bring tears to our eyes. Tell me the name of that prodigious man yonder. Who is he, that big handsome man? Others there are a head taller, that is true, but so fine a man I never did see, or so royal. He is every inch a king." Helen answered, "You do me honor, my dear good father. How I wish I had died before I followed your son here, and left my bridal chamber and my family, my beloved daughter and all my young friends. But that was not to be, and so I pine away in sorrow. But I must answer your question. That is the great King Agamemnon of the house of Atreus, a good king and a strong spearman both. He was my own good brother, to my shame, as sure as ever he was born." The old man gazed at him with admiration and said, "Atrides, you are blessed indeed, a son of fortune happy in your lot. A great nation indeed is under your sway. I have traveled as far as vine-clad Phrygia, and there I saw a host of Phrygian men with their dapple nags. the people of Otreus and splendid Mygdon, who were there campaigning on the banks of Sangarius, for I was among them as a volunteer on the day when the Amazons came, those women as good as men. But all those hosts were not so many as the Achaeans here. Next the old man asked about Odysseus. "Tell me again, dear child, who is that? A head shorter than my lord King Agamemnon, but broader in shoulders and chest. His arms lie on the ground, and he is patrolling the ranks of men like a tame wether. Indeed, he looks very like a thick-fleeced ram marching through a flock of white ewes." Helen answered, "That is Odysseus, Laertes' son, the man who is never at a loss. He was bred in Ithaca, a rugged, rocky land. There is no device or invention which he does not know." At this, Antenor broke in. "Yes, my lady," he said, "you have spoken nothing but the truth. Odysseus has been here already. He came with Menelaus on a mission concerning yourself. I entertained them both in my house, and I got to know their looks and their many inventions. When they came before our assembly, standing Menelaus was head and shoulders above him. While they both sat, Odysseus was more dignified. But when they put the patterns of their minds and inventions into words before us all, Menelaus ran smoothly on, said not much but very clearly, for he was not one of many words or one to miss the right word, yet he was the younger man. Then Odysseus rose, this man who is never at a loss. He would stand with his eyes fixed on the ground, didn't move the staff backwards or forwards, but held it stiff like a dull fellow. You would call him surly and stupid, both. But as soon as he let out his great voice from his chest, and a shower of words falling thick and soft like snowflakes in wintertime, no other man alive could come near Odysseus. But then we did not think him so very much to look at." Then the old man saw Aias, and asked again, "Who is that other big, handsome man among the Achaeans, standing head and broad shoulders above the rest?" Helen answered, "That giant of a man is Aias, a real tower of strength, and opposite him is Idomeneus, standing among his Cretan captains like a god. Menelaus often entertained him in our house when he used to come over from Crete. And now I can see all the others that I know, and I can tell you their names, but two I cannot see, two young princes, Castor, who can tame any horse, and Pelagius, the boxer, my own two brothers, my own mother's sons. I wonder if they never left Lacedaemon, or perhaps they did come, and now they will not show themselves in the field because I have brought all that shame upon them." But it was not as she said. Already Mother Earth held them fast, far away in Lacedaemon, their own native land. By this time the heralds in the city were bringing the lambs for the sacrifice and the generous wine in a goatskin. Idaeus, holding a large bowl and golden cups, came up to the old king and said, "Rise up, Laomedontiades, you are summoned by the chief captains of the embattled hosts of Ilios and Achaea to come down into the plain and to make a sworn league of friendship. Alexandros and Menelaus will fight with long spears for the woman. The victor shall hold both woman and wealth. But we shall all make a sworn league of friendship, that we may hold our own rich land, and they may return to their country of noble horses and fair women." The old man shivered, but he ordered his men to harness the horses, and they set to with a will. Priam entered the car and picked up the reins. Antenor took his place beside him, and they drove the team swiftly through the Scaean gates. When they reached the plain, they dismounted between the two armies. Then Agamemnon rose up, and Odysseus. The heralds solemnly brought the offerings together, and mixed wine in the bowl, and poured water over the two kings' hands. Agamemnon drew the knife which hung by the sheath of his great sword and cut hairs from the lambs' heads. The heralds gave some to the chief men on each side. Then Agamemnon lifted up his hands and prayed in a loud voice, "O Father Zeus, almighty and most gracious Lord of Ida, O Sun, who seest all things and hearest all things, O rivers and earth, and ye too who in the world below punish after death men who swear a false oath, be you witnesses, keep this oath sacred. If Alexandros shall kill Menelaus, then let him keep Helen and all her wealth, and we will return home with our fleet. But if Menelaus shall kill Alexandros, the Trojans shall give up Helen and all her wealth, and they shall pay to the Argives such compensation as is proper, such as may be noised abroad in generations to come. And if the compensation shall not be paid by Priam and Priam's sons when Alexandros falls, then I will fight for satisfaction, and here I will stay until I shall end the war. Then he cut the throats of the lambs and laid them upon the ground, struggling and gasping for breath when the knife had taken their strength away. The wine was drawn from the bowl and poured into the cups, and they offered prayer to the deathless gods. This was the prayer of Trojans and Achaeans alike. O Zeus, almighty and most glorious, and all ye immortal gods, if either of our nations hurt the other against this oath, may their brains run out on the ground like this wine, theirs and their children's, and may their wives be servants to others. But Zeus Cronion did not bring that yet to fulfillment. Now Priam Dardanides spoke. Hear me, Trojans and Achaean men of war. I am going back to the city, since I cannot endure to see my dear son fighting with Menelaus. Zeus knows, the gods know, which of the two is destined to die. He took the lambs with him and entered the chariot and picked up the reins. Antenor took his place beside him, and they drove away. But Hector and Odysseus first measured out a space, then put lots in a helmet and shook them for the first spear cast. The men on each side lifted up their hands and prayed, O Father Zeus, almighty and most glorious Lord of Ida, whichever of these two brought the troubles upon both our nations, grant that he may perish and go down to the house of Hades, and grant that we may have friendship and keep this oath. Then Hector shook the helmet, looking behind him. In a moment the lot of Paris leapt out. The others all sat down in ranks beside their horses and armor, while Alexandros armed himself. First he put on his fine greaves with silver anklets, next a corselet across his chest, his brother Lycaon's, which fitted him. Over his shoulders he slung the sword with silver knobs, then a strong broad shield, and upon his head a fine helmet with horsehair plume that shook fit to frighten a man. Last he caught up a spear that suited his grip. Menelaus also armed himself in the same way. Now the two strode out into the middle with grim looks that struck awe into all beholders. They came to a stand in the measured space, shaking their spears at each other in defiance. Alexandros first cast his spear. Menelaus caught it neatly upon the shield. The spear did not break through the metal, but the point was bent. Menelaus had the second shot, and before he cast he made his prayer to Father Zeus. O Lord Zeus, grant vengeance upon Alexandros, who has wronged me unprovoked. Bring him low by my hand, that many a man may shudder in long generations to come at the thought of wronging a friend who shows him hospitality. He balanced the spear and cast it and struck the shield of Alexandros. Right through the shield ran the stout spear, tore right through his corselet and cut through the tunic along his side, but he swerved away from his death. Then Atrides drew his sword and, stretching over, struck the horn of the helmet, but the blade broke upon it in three or four splinters and fell from his hand. Atrides groaned and looked up to heaven, crying, O Father Zeus, such an unkind god as you there never was! You do spoil everything! I did think I had paid out that scoundrel, and here is my sword broken in my hand, and my spear missed and never touched him! He made one leap and caught hold of the horsehair plume, turned and dragged Alexandros towards his own ranks. The helmet strap choked him, pulled tight under his chin, and Menelaus almost got him. A glorious victory it would have been, but Aphrodite saw it and broke the strap. So all he got was the empty helmet. He threw it over with a swing to his friends and leapt back to kill his enemy with the spear. But Aphrodite carried him off in a thick mist, as a god can easily do, and put him down in Helen's sweet-scented chamber. Now she took the shape of an old woman who used to comb wool for Helen in her old home before she left Lacedaemon, one whom she dearly loved. In this shape she went in search of Helen. She found her on the battlements with a crowd of women and plucked her by the skirt. "Come here," she said. "Thy man wants thee at home. He's in thy room, on the bed, all finery and shinery. Thee'st never think he's fresh from fighting a man. More like just come from a dance, or just gone, maybe." These words stirred Helen's temper. Now she knew the goddess by her beautiful throat and lovely breast and shining eyes. She was amazed and cried out, "This is strange indeed. Why do you wish to befool me? Will you carry me away somewhere still farther off, to some city of Frisia or Maeonia, where you have another friend among the sons of men? I suppose Menelaus has killed him and wants to take me home, the woman whom he hates. I suppose that's why you are here, with more of your tricks and schemes. Go and sit by him yourself. Forget the way to Olympus, and never let your feet feel it again. Fuss about the man, take good care of him, and perhaps he will make you his wife one day, or his slave, at least. To that place I will not go. It would be a shame. I will not make his bed. What will the Trojan women say? And I have troubles enough already." The goddess flew into a rage and said, "Don't try me too far, hard-hearted woman, or I may be angry and leave you, and hate you as much as I love you desperately now. I may make Trojans and Danians hate each other like death, so that you will have a cruel fate between them." Helen was terrified and followed her in silence, wrapping her robe close about her. The other women saw nothing. When they reached the house, her attendants turned to their work, and she went up to her room. Aphrodite, all smiles, put a chair for her in front of Alexandros, and there Helen sat down. But she turned her eyes away and said with contempt, "You have come back from the battle. I wish you had died there, and a strong man had killed you, he that was my husband before you. It was your boast once that you were the better man in a fair fight. Then go and challenge Menelaus to fight again. But no, I advise you not to try. Fight no duel with Menelaus. Leave him alone, don't be a fool, or perhaps you may go down before his spear." Paris answered, "You need not scold me, my dear. This time Menelaus has won because Athena helped him. Next time it will be my turn, for I have my gods too. Let us love and be happy. I was never so much in love before, not even when I carried you off in my ship from Lacedaemon, and we shared our first love in that island. I am more in love with you now than ever, and I want you more." So saying, he lay down on the bed, and she came to him. While they lay there together, Menelaus was striding up and down like a wild beast, looking everywhere for Alexandros. But no one could show him a glimpse of Alexandros among the Trojans or their allies. Not for love. They were not going to hide him if they did see him, for they all hated him like black death. At last my lord Agamemnon said before them all, "Take notice, Trojans and Dardanians and allied nations, victory lies with Menelaus, as you see. Your duty is then to hand over Helen and all her wealth, and pay whatever compensation is right and proper, such as may be noised abroad in generations to come." And all the Achaeans raised a cheer. Book 4. The First Battle Between Trojans and Achaeans. The gods were all in their places on the golden floor, sitting with Zeus in conclave. Hebe went round with the nectar, and they pledged one another with their golden goblets, while they watched what was going on before Troy. Suddenly Zeus thought he would tease Hera a little, and he said in a mocking tone to draw her, "Two of our august company are allies of Menelaus. I mean Hera, who backs Argos, of course, and our Boeotian guardian Athena. But here they are both keeping out of the way and watching the show with great enjoyment. And there is the enemy, there is Aphrodite, always beside him, all smiles, keeping off the shots. Look, there, now, she has just saved him when he thought he was a dead man. But there's no doubt victory goes to Menelaus. Let us consider what is to be done. Shall we make them begin the war again and fight it out, or shall we make them friends? If that is good and pleasing in the sight of all, the city of Priam may still remain inhabited, and Menelaus can take his Helen back to Argos. Athena and Hera were close together, plotting trouble for Troy. When he said this, they were both furious and grunted something. Athena held her tongue, but Hera could not find room for all the fury inside her, and she cried out, "Oh, you dreadful creature, what a thing to say! How can you wish me to waste all my trouble for nothing? How I sweated and sweated! All my drudgery thrown away, the horses tired out with collecting the people to destroy Priam and his sons. Go on, do as you like, but let me tell you, we do not all agree." Zeus Cloud-Gatherer was angry himself now. He said, "Oh, you amazing creature, what harm has Priam or Priam's sons done to you, that you never cease trying to make a wilderness of the noble city? Go through the gates, go into the fortress, munch up Priam raw with Priam's sons and all his people, and then perhaps you could cure that fury of yours. Very well, do as you please. I have my fears that this quarrel may leave a bitter grudge between us. But one thing I tell you, and don't forget it, if I ever want to destroy some city where you have friends of yours, do not try to thwart my vengeance, but leave me alone. I will not be the only one to say yes when I wanted to say no. For of all the cities of mortal men which are built under the stars of heaven, I have always loved best sacred Ilios, and King Priam and the people of that fine old soldier king. My altar there never lacked public feast, or the savor of burnt offering and drink offering, which is our solemn rite." His queen opened her great eyes wide and said, "I tell you, there are three cities which I love best, Argos and Sparta and the broad seats of Mycenae. Sack them all whenever you take a dislike to them. I tell you, I do not defend them or care about them, for even if I grudge it and ask you to spare them, what is the use of my grudging? You are much stronger than I am. Still, I have my rights, too. My trouble ought not to go for nothing, since I am a god, too. Of the same birth as yourself, eldest daughter of Crookmind Kronos, eldest and most honorable, both by birth and because I am called your wife and you are lord of the immortals. Come, then, let us give way to each other, I to you and you to me. Then all the others will go with us. But now be quick, and send down Athena to the battlefield. Let her contrive somehow to get the Trojans to break the oath and attack those overproud Achaeans before the others can." Zeus did not refuse. He told Athena in plain words what he wanted. "Look sharp. Go right into the battle and contrive, somehow or other, to get these Trojans to break their oath and attack before the others can." Athena was only too glad to do it and shot down from the peaks of Olympus. Like a blazing star which the Lord of Heaven shoots forth, bright and scattering sparks all around, to be a portent for sailors or for some great army of men, so Pallas Athena shot down to earth and leapt into the throng, to the amazement of Trojans and Achaeans both. You might have heard one man say to another, "This means more battles and hard fighting," or else, "Here is friendship set up between us by Zeus, the dispenser of war." Athena now took the form of a Trojan, the doughty warrior Laodocus, Antenor's son, and went about searching for Pandarus. She found him standing among the ranks of targeteers who had marched with him from Aesepus River, and she spoke to him plainly, "Will you take my advice and show your good skill? Then dare to have a quick shot at Menelaus. This will give you great credit, and all the Trojans will thank you, most of all Prince Alexandros. He will be the first to heap rewards upon you if he sees that mighty man of war, King Menelaus, brought down by your arrow and laid out on a funeral pyre. Come along, have a shot at Menelaus, and offer your vow to Apollo Lysigenes, prince of archers, that you will make a solemn sacrifice of firstling lambs when you return home to the sacred city of Zelia." He let himself be persuaded. Poor fool! and at once he stripped his bow. This was a bow made from the polished horns of a wild ibex, which he had once caught while out hunting. He had shot it through the chest as it came from behind a rock and knocked it back upon the rock. The two horns measured 16 hands from the head. A skillful horner had worked it and fitted the pieces together, polished them up, and put a gold hook on the top. Pandarus steadied the end on the ground and strung the bow, then laid it down carefully, while his friends held their shields before him, for fear that the Achaeans might get up to their feet before Menelaus was hit. Then he stripped off the quiver lid and chose a feathered arrow which had never been shot, a carrier of black pains indeed. Without delay he fitted the arrow to the string and made his vow to Apollo Lysigenes, prince of archers, that he would offer solemn sacrifice of firstling lambs when he returned home to the sacred city of Zelia. He took fast hold of the string and the notches together and drew back the string to his breast, the iron point to the bow. So he drew it into a great round. Clang went the bow, jing went the string, out leapt the arrow, and flew sharp and fast, fierce to strike. But the immortal gods did not forget you, Menelaus, and Athena first and foremost stood before you and saved you from the arrow's point. She just swept it away from the flesh, as a mother sweeps away a fly from her sleeping child. And she made it go straight where the golden buckles of the belt were joined, and the corselet was folded over. The arrow struck right on the buckle. Through the belt it drove, through the corselet, and the loin piece which he wore to protect his flesh from a thrust, his last and chief defense, it went through that also. And the arrow pierced his skin, so that red blood ran down from the wound over his thighs and shins and ankles. The red blood on his fine white skin was like vermilion on ivory, when some clever craftswoman, Carian or Meonian, makes a cheek piece for horses. See it stored in a treasure chamber. Many a horseman would love to use it, but the treasure lies waiting for a king to make the horse fine and the driver proud. My lord King Agamemnon shuddered when he saw the red blood running out of the wound. Menelaus himself shuddered. But when he noticed that barbs and binding were outside, he recovered his spirits again. Agamemnon groaned deep as he caught his brother by the hand, and the men groaned. Then he said, "Dear brother, it was death for you when I swore that oath and put you in front of the fight as our champion, for the enemy have shot you and trampled their oath underfoot. But an oath is not an empty form, nor is the blood of lambs and drink offerings and hands clasped in which we put our trust. For even if the Olympian does not act at once, he will act at last, and a heavy price men have to pay, their own heads, their own wives, and their children. I know full well in my heart of hearts that a day shall come when sacred Troy shall perish, and the people of Priam, the mighty king, when Zeus Cronides, enthroned on high in the heavens, himself will shake his black mantle over them in wrath for this deceit. This indeed shall be, and shall not fail. But you will bring dreadful pain upon me, Menelaus, if you die now and fill up your count of days. In deep disgrace I should return to Argos, for our people would at once remember their native land, and we should leave to Priam and his Trojans their boast, our Argive Helen. But your bones would lie in the enemy's land, and rot there with your work undone. The Trojans would stamp in triumph on the tomb of Menelaus, and cry aloud, 'I wish Agamemnon the same good luck against his other enemies as he has had here with his contemptible army. Just look now, he has sailed away with empty ships and left brave Menelaus behind.' But if that should ever come true, may the earth open and swallow me up." Menelaus made light of it and said, "Take courage and don't alarm the men. It is not a mortal wound. The belt saved me first, and then my kilt underneath, and the good armorer's work of the loin piece." Agamemnon answered, "God grant it, my dear man. But we must see to this wound. The surgeon shall feel it and put some stuff in to ease the pain." Then he called out, "Tell Thebeus, bring Machaon here as quick as you can. You know the fellow, Asclepius' son, the surgeon, and a good one too. Let him see to King Menelaus. Someone has shot him with an arrow, some Trojan or some Lycian it will be. They are good archers, and it was a fine shot, I must say, but bad luck for us. Talthybius went off at once, looking everywhere in the lines for Machaon. At last he found him standing among his own targeteers, the men from Tricca. Talthybius came up and told him plainly what had happened. "Quick, Asclepius, King Agamemnon wants you to have a look at our commander Menelaus. Someone has shot him with an arrow, a Trojan, or some good Lycian archer. He says it was a fine shot, but bad luck for us." Machaon was alarmed, and together they made their way through the lines. Soon they reached the place where the wounded man stood, with a crowd of nobles round him. Machaon pulled out the arrow, and the barbs broke in the belt as he pulled it back. Then he loosened the belt and the kilt and the loin piece underneath. He found the wound and sucked out the blood and put on a plaster of soothing drugs. These were drugs which dear old Chiron had given to his father, and he knew them well. While they were attending to Menelaus, the Trojans began to come on under arms, and so the Achaeans armed themselves and prepared for battle. Then you would not see Agamemnon napping or shirking or unready to fight. No, he was all eagerness for battle and glory. He left car and snorting horses in charge of his man Eurymedon and ordered him strictly to keep them at hand until he should want a rest from his labors. Then he marched through the ranks on foot to give his orders. If he found the men brisk and lively, he encouraged them with a few words. "Stick to it, men! To it with all your might! Liars will not have Father Zeus to help them. Those who began it, those who broke their solemn oath, shall be a dainty meal for the vultures, and we will take their city and carry off their wives and children in shiploads." But if he found any slack and cursing the war, he rated them roughly. "Call yourselves fighting men, long-distance champions with the bow is what I call you. A disgrace to the army. Have you no shame? Why do you stand there like a herd of deer, tired with running about all over the place, dazed and helpless? Yes, you stand there dazed and afraid to fight. Perhaps you are waiting till the enemy come as far as your ships. Fine ships, aren't they, all along the shore? You want to see whether God will spread his hand over you." So he went through the army, giving his orders to all. By and by he came to the Cretans, who were arming under their captain Idomeneus. He was in the front rank, furious as a wild boar. Meriones was speeding up the rear. This was a pleasant sight to the king, and he said in a friendly tone, "Idomeneus, you are the man for me, first at a feast and first in the field. Here you are, hard at work, and what when the big men have a banquet and bring out the best company wine to fill the flowing bowl, the others drink what is given them, but you always have a full bumper by your side, as I do, and as much as you like to drink. Now then, hey for battle, and keep up your reputation." Idomeneus answered, "Sir, I will not fail you. I am your loyal servant, as I promised and gave my pledge to be. But you should speed up the others and let us get to fighting as soon as we can, for the Trojans have broken their oath. Death and disaster shall be their lot, because they began it by breaking that oath." Agamemnon left him well satisfied. And next he came upon great Aeus and his little namesake, who were arming themselves amid a cloud of footmen. Thick black clumps of sturdy yonkers moved towards the battle, bristling with spears and shields, like some heavy cloud blown over the deep by the west wind. The goat-herd sees it afar from his watching place, blacker than pitch over the deep as the whirlwind drives, and he shudders and guides his herd into a cave. My lord Agamemnon was glad to see this sight, and he told them what he thought in plain words. "You need no pressing from me, you doughty pair of captains. That you do for yourselves, and on your people go. Oh, Father Zeus, Apollo, Athenea, I wish all the others had the same temper. Then King Priam's castle would soon bow down its head, and we should sack it and lay it waste with our hands." He passed on to Nestor, and found him among his Pelians, giving orders in that sonorous voice, placing his men and sending them out under his captains, Pelagon and Alastor, Chromius and Haemon and Prince Bias. In front he put the cars with horses and drivers, behind them the footmen, in formidable array like a wall, with the cowards in the middle so that they would have to fight whether they liked it or not. He was giving his orders, first to the men in the chariots, to keep their horses in hand and not to go rattling about in the melee.
"Don't try to show off your driving and your courage. No one is to dash out in front and fight by himself. No one is to move to the rear. Keep your line, or you'll only be the weaker. But if anyone comes within reach of an enemy car, try a spear thrust. That's the way to fight. Many a strong city has been taken by those tactics."
The old man had seen war before, and he knew all about it. Agamemnon was glad, and he told him plainly how he felt.
"You may be old, sir, but I only wish your knees were as nimble and your strength as firm as the temper in that heart of yours. Ah, well, such is life. Old age is old age. I only wish others were old and you were young."
The old hero loved a good horse, and he answered,
"Ah, your grace, I do wish indeed I were now as young as I was when I killed Ereuthalion. Well, well, the gods do not give us everything at the same time. If I was young, then I am old now. Never mind, I will be with the horses and tell these people what to do. Words are the privilege of an old man. Spearing with spears is the young men's work. They have more youth and more strength than I have."
Agamemnon passed on in great contentment. He found Menestheus standing among his warlike Athenians. Not far off was Odysseus and the Cephallenian division. These were no weaklings, but they had not heard the call to arms, for the opposing armies had only just begun to move, and they stood waiting until some other battalion should come up and give them a lead. But Agamemnon rated them soundly and left no mistake as to his feelings.
"You, Menestheus, what would your royal father say to see you here? And you, the master of mischievous tricks, what cunning scheme is hidden in your mind? Why do you skulk in the rear and wait for a lead? You ought to be standing right in front and facing the fire. You are always first to hear my invitation whenever we give a dinner to the great men. Then you are pleased to eat your roast beef and to drink your nice wine at your ease. Now you would be pleased to see a dozen battalions go out before you to the fight."
Odysseus frowned and replied,
"What a thing to say, prince. Bite it back and let it stay behind your teeth. Do you say we are slack when our people go out to battle? You shall see for yourself if you like. And if such matters interest you, you shall see the father of Telemachus fighting in the enemy's front line. What you say is so much wind."
Agamemnon smiled when he saw him angry and took back his words.
"No, no, Odysseus Laertiades, I know the master of stratagems. You do not want my scolding or ordering. I know the loyalty of your heart, for we are of one mind, you and I. Come along, we will make it all right by and by if any harm has been said. Let us forget it, for God's sake."
He passed on, and the next he found was Tygius' son, proud Diomedes, standing amongst his chariots and horses, with Sthenelus, Capaneus's son, beside him. Agamemnon rated him, too, in plain language.
"What pity to find you skulking here, goggling your eyes at the battlefield. What would your noble father have said? It was not your father's way to skulk. He used to be the first at the enemy, by a long way, as they say who saw him about the business. I never met him myself, never saw him, but they say he had no equal. Once, indeed, he came to Messene. Not in war, he came as a guest with Prince Polynices to enlist men, for they were besieging the sacred walls of Thebes. They begged hard for volunteers, and the people were ready to go, but Zeus changed their minds by showing unfavorable signs. So the envoys went away and got as far as the river Asopus. There they waited in the reeds and grass while Tygius went on a parley to Thebes. He found a party of the Cadmeans feasting in the house of Eteocles. There was Tygius alone among a host of Cadmeans, a stranger. But he feared nothing. He challenged them to trials of strength and beat them all easily by the help of Athena. Then the Cadmeans were enraged and laid an ambush for him on his way home. 40 lads with 2 leaders, Maeon, Haemon's son, and Polyphontes, the son of Autophonus. Tygius made an end of these also. He killed them, all but one whom he sent back. Maeon was the man, and he let him go in obedience to omens from heaven. Such a man was Aetolian Tygius, but his son is not so good on the battlefield, although he is a better talker."
Diomedes made no answer, for he respected the king's reproof. But Sthenelus spoke out,
"My lord, do not say what is false when you know the truth. We are better men than our fathers, and we are proud of it. We took the fortress of Seven-Gate Thebes, although we had a weaker force against a stronger wall, because we trusted in the help of Zeus and omens from the gods above. But our fathers perished through their own reckless folly, so please don't put them equal to us."
But Diomedes frowned at him and said, "Hold your tongue, old boy, and listen to me. I do not take it ill that his grace would urge the men to fight. He is our commander, and we are his men. He will have the glory if his men destroy the sacred city of Ilios. He will have the grief if his men are defeated. Come along, and let us join the battle."
As he said the words, he leapt out of his car, and his armor clanged loudly upon him. It was enough to strike fear into a brave heart. Then the Danaan battalions moved on to battle, line after line. As the long billows roll to the shore, line after line, when the west wind drives, the swell gathers head far out on the sea, then bursts on the land in thunder, rearing and curving its crest about the headlands and spitting out the salt spray. So the army moved, each mass with its own leaders. Their words of command were heard, and the rest marched in silence, so that you might think that all that mighty host were dumb men, clad in shining armor. But loud, clamorous cries resounded throughout the Trojan host, for they had not one speech and one language, but a confusion of tongues, since they were called from many lands. They were like a huge flock of ewes, innumerable, standing in a wide farmyard to be milked, which bleat without ceasing as they hear the cries of their lambs. Ares marshaled the Trojans, Athena bright-eyes the others, along with terror and rout and discord, ever restless, sister and comrade of bloodthirsty Ares. She is little at first, then her crest rises, and she thrusts her head against the heavens while she strides upon the earth. So then discord cast direful war among them, marching through the throng and multiplying troubles for mankind. Now the two armies met, dashing shield against shield and spear against spear, fury meeting fury in the mailed ranks. The embossed bucklers, clashing, made a dreadful din. Here was groaning, there shouts of triumph as men slew and men were slain, and the earth ran with blood. The uproar and the turmoil were like two great rivers in flood, pouring down a mass of water from the mountains into a deep ravine where two valleys meet, and the sound is heard far away by shepherds upon the hills. First blood to Archelochus, who killed a Trojan champion in the front rank, Echepolus Thalassiades. He struck the man on his horsehair plume, and the spear point pierced his forehead, running into the bone. Darkness covered his eyes, and he fell flat, like a tower in the melee. When he fell, Elephenor caught him by the feet, Elephenor Chalcodontiades, captain of the Abantians, and tried to drag him out under the spears, for he wanted to strip him of his armor, but the struggle was soon over. For while he was dragging the body with his own side, uncovered as he stooped, Anginor saw him and ran him through with his spear. So Elephenor fell and died, and over his body there was sharp work between Trojans and Achaeans, who leapt upon one another like wolves and knocked each other about. Then Telamonian Aeus struck down Anthemion's boy, the lusty lad Simoeisius. They called him Simoeisius because he was born beside the river Simois, while his mother was on the way from Ida with her parents to visit their flocks. He never repaid the son's debt to his parents, for he died young by the spear of Aeus. As he stepped out in front, Aeus struck him on the right breast by the nipple. The spear ran right through his shoulder, and he fell. There he lay like a poplar tree which has grown up in the hollow of a great marsh, a smooth stem with branches growing at the top. Some cartwright has cut it down with his axe to bend into the fellow of a fine car, and there it lies drying on the river bank. So Simoeisius, when Aeus struck him down. And Antiphos, one of the sons of Priam, cast a spear at Aeus. He missed Aeus, but hit Leucus, a good comrade of Odysseus, in the groin as he was dragging the man away, so that he fell flat over the body and let go. Odysseus was enraged to see his friend fall. He strode forward to the place, looking round watchfully, and the Trojans shrank back as he cast his spear and struck down a bastard son of Priam, Demochoon, who had come at his father's summons from the mares at Abydos. That was the counterstroke for his friend's death. The spear pierced the man's temple, and darkness came over his eyes. He fell with a thud amid his crashing armor. Then the first ranks gave ground, and Hector with them. The Achaeans, cheering, dragged away the slain and moved a long way forward. But Apollo looked down out of Pergamos in anger and called aloud, "On, Trojans, on! Do not give way to Achaeans. Their flesh is not stone nor iron. Volley away, and your points will cut their skins. And now there's no Achilles to fight for them. He is away by the ships, nursing his grievance in a bitter heart." The awful voice of the god resounded from the city walls, but Athena was in the field. Up and down went the most glorious Tritogeneer when she saw any giving way. Then fate caught hold of Diores Amarynciades. He was struck by a jagged stone on the right shin near the ankle. A Thracian captain threw it, Pyrrhos Ibrisides, who came from Enos. The cruel stone smashed the bones and both sinews, and the man fell backwards in the dust, holding out both hands to his friends as he breathed his last. For Pyrrhos ran up and thrust him through by the mid-nipple. His bowels gushed out, and darkness came over his eyes. But as Pyrrhus sprang back, Aetolian Thoas cast a spear at his breast and pierced the lung. Thoas ran up and pulled out the spear, then drew his sword and struck him right in the belly, which was his death. But he did not strip off the armor, for there were other Thracians round him, with the topknots on their heads and the long spears in their hands, who drove him back, staggering for all his size and strength. So these two lay in the dust together, Thracian captain beside the Achaean, and many others fell round about. No one could make light of that battle, if any indeed were left untouched and unwounded, if Pallas Athena took him by the hand and led him through the mist, if she kept him free of hurt, for many Trojans and many Achaeans fell on that day, and lay prone in the dust, side by side. Book 5. How Diomedes did great deeds of valor, and wounded Aphrodite and Ares himself. Now comes the turn of Diomedes, Tydeus' son. For Pallas Athena gave him courage and boldness to make him come to the front and cover himself with glory. She kindled the flame that blazed steadily from his helmet and shield, like the star that shines brightest of all in late summer after his bath in the ocean. Such was the fire that blazed from the head and shoulders of Diomedes when she drove him through the midst where the fighting was thickest. There was one Dares among the Trojans, a man of substance and worth, a priest of Hephaestus. He had two sons, Phegeus and Idaeus, both fine soldiers. These two came out to meet Diomedes, they in their car, he on foot. When they came within range, Phegeus began by casting a spear at Diomedes. The spear passed over his left shoulder without touching him. Diomedes countered with a cast which did not miss. It struck the other full in the breast and rolled him out of the car. Then Idaeus leapt out, but he durst not bestride his brother's body, and he would never have escaped himself, but Hephaestus hid him in darkness and saved him, that his old father might not be wholly bereaved. Diomedes drove off the team and gave it in charge to his friends. The Trojans were all dismayed at the fate of these two, one dead beside his car and one gone. Then Athena caught Ares by the hand and said, "Ares, Ares, you men's bane, you bloodthirsty fort-stormer, why can't we leave Trojans and Achaeans to fight and see which of them Father Zeus will favor? Do let us two retire and keep clear of the anger of Zeus." So she led Ares away and found him a seat on the lofty bank of Scamandros. Now the Danians drove back their enemy, and each of the captains brought down his man. First King Agamemnon. Odius, the Halizonian chief, was the first to turn, and Agamemnon drove his spear between the shoulders and out at the chest. He fell with a crash in his rattling armor. Next, Idomeneus brought down Phaestus, the son of Meonian Boros from Tani. Idomeneus pierced his right shoulder as he was mounting his car. He fell out of the car, and darkness took him. While the grooms were stripping off his armor, King Menelaus killed Strophius' son, Scamandrios. A great hunter he was, a mighty hunter, for Artemis herself taught him to kill all the wild beasts which the mountain forest breeds. But no help was there for him then from Artemis Archeris, nor the long shots for which he was famous. Menelaus caught him as he fled and ran him through the back between the shoulders. The spear came out through his chest, and he fell on his face under his rattling armor. Meriones again killed Phereclus. This was the son of Tecton Harmonides, an artist who knew how to make all sorts of lovely and precious things with his own hands, for Pallas Athena loved him well. It was he that built those fine ships for Alexandros, the beginning of all the troubles, which were the ruin of himself and all the people of Troy, for he knew nothing of what God had ordained. Meriones chased him and caught him and struck him in the right groin. The point ran through the bladder under the bone. He fell groaning upon his knees, and death covered him up. Then Meges slew Pedaeus. He was the bastard son of Antenor, but the lady Theano brought him up as lovingly as her own children to please her husband. Meges struck him on the sinew behind the head, and the blade cut his tongue at the root and went through the teeth. He fell in the dust, biting hard on the cold metal. Eurypylus, Eumaeon's son, killed Hypsenor, the son of Dolopion. He was priest of Scamandros, honored among the people as if he were himself a god. Eurypylus gave chase, and with a sweep of his sword cut off the man's arm at the shoulder as they ran. The arm fell bleeding on the ground, and dark death took his eyes. A cruel fate. So the hard business of the fight went on. As for Diomedes, you could not tell which side he belonged to, Trojan or Achaean, for he stormed all over the plain, and the dense battalions of the enemy rolled away in confusion before him. That great company would not stand. It was like some winter torrent in flood, which thrusts away all dikes. No dike can hold it, no walls of the fruitful orchards, when it comes with a sudden burst, swollen by the pouring rain, and beats down in ruin the noble works of strong men. When Pandarus saw Diomedes storming over the plain and rolling the battalions before him, he aimed an arrow quickly at him and hit him on the right shoulder on the plate of the corselet as he came rushing on. The sharp point ran right through, and the blood ran over the corselet. Then Pandarus shouted, "On, Trojans! On, my brave horsemen! I have shot the best of the Achaeans! I do not think he will last long after that shot, if Lord Apollo really did send me here from Lycia." There was a boast for you. But the shot did not bring the man down. He drew back and stood in front of his horses, and said to Sthenelus, "Wake up, old fellow. Look sharp and get down from that car and pull this arrow from my shoulder." Sthenelus was down with one leap at his side, and he pulled the arrow right through the shoulder. The blood shot out in a spurt through the tunic. Then bold Diomedes prayed aloud to his goddess, "Hear me, O daughter of Zeus, almighty Atriene. If thou didst ever stand by my father's side in friendship on the battlefield, now again show thy love to me, Athena. Grant me to come within spear-cast of that man, and to slay that man who shot me unawares, and now declares boasting that I shall not long see the light of the sun." Pallas Athena heard his prayer. She made his limbs nimble, the feet and hands on him, and spoke in words that winged like arrows to the mark. "Courage now, Diomedes, and fight away, for I have put your father's courage in your breast, the fearless courage of that shield-shaking master of horses. And I have taken away the mist which was upon your eyes, that you may know man from God. Then, if some god comes here to try you, never fight against any god except Aphrodite. But if she comes into the field, you may wound her with your spear." With these words Athena left him, and he returned to the front of the battle. If he had been eager to fight before, now he was three times as wild. He was like a lion when he has leapt into the sheepfold after the woolly flocks, and the shepherd has wounded but not killed him. But this only makes the lion more furious, and the shepherd defends the sheep no more but slinks into the hut and leaves them helpless in panic. They huddle in heaps, and the maddened beast leaps out of the fold. So Diomedes, maddened, fell upon the Trojans. There he slew Astynous and Hippyron, one with a thrust through the breast, one with a sword stroke on the collarbone near the shoulder that shaved the shoulder clean off. These he left, and chased Abas and Polyidos, the two sons of Eurydamas, the old diviner of dreams. They never came back for the old man to read their dreams for them, but strong Diomedes killed them. Then he went after Xanthos and Thoon, the two sons of Phenops, whom their father loved well. But his old age was passed in sorrow, and he got no other son for his possessions. They were killed, both, and stripped. And they left mourning and lamentation for their father. They lived not to be welcomed home from the war, and their kinsmen divided the goods. Then he took two sons of Priam Dardanides, Achaemen and Chromius, in the same chariot. As a lion leaps among cattle grazing under the trees and breaks the neck of a cow or heifer, so this unwelcome visitor smashed them out of their car and stripped them of their armor, the team he gave to his men to drive away. When Aeneas saw him running riot in the field, he went searching amid the melee to see if he could find Pandarus anywhere. He found that formidable man and said to him, "Where is your bow now, Pandarus? Where are your winged arrows? Where is that fame in which you have here no rival and none in Lycia? Come now, lift up your hands to Zeus, and then have a shot at this man who is master of the field. Look what damage he has done already, how many good men he has brought down. I wonder if he is some god who has a grievance against our people and wants a sacrifice. Heavy is the wrath of God upon men." Pandarus answered, "There speaks Aeneas, the wise counselor. Indeed, yon man is exactly like Diomedes, if I may judge by the shield and the vizard, and I can see his horses. But I am not sure he is not really a god. If he is only a man, the clever son of Tydeus does not run mad like this without a god to back him. There must be some god beside him, invisible. And he turned the shot aside even as it hit the man, for I have tried already, and I hit the right shoulder through the corselet plate. I thought I should send him to Hades, but yet I did not bring him down. It must be some angry god. And I have no horses here, and no car for my use. Yet my father has 11 fine chariots covered up carefully somewhere in his place, new built, new finished, with a pair of horses for each champing rye and barley in the stable. How often the old warrior advised me when I was coming here to mount my car and drive my team and take the lead in the battle, but I would not listen. I only wish I had. The truth is, I wanted to spare the horses. I thought they might lack fodder in all this crowd of men when they were used to plenty. So I left them behind and came as a footman, with only my bow and arrows. And they were to do no good, as it seems, for I have already shot two of the champions, Tydides and Atrides, and hit them fair and drew blood from both. But it only made them more lively. So it was bad luck when I took my bow from Peg on the day when I led my men to this beautiful city to please Prince Hector. Well, when I get home again and set my eyes on my native land and my wife and my tall house, if I don't break up these useless sticks with my own hands and chuck them into the fire, I will let a perfect stranger come in and chop off my head." Aeneas answered, "No, no, don't say that. We shall do no good until you and I drive against the man and see what spears can do. Up with you, into my car, and I'll show you what the horses of Tros are like. They know how to put on the pace, into the battle or out of the battle. They will carry us safe to the city if Zeus lets Diomedes win. Here, take whip and reins, and I will get out and do the fighting, or tackle him yourself, and I will drive." Pandarus answered, "You take the reins, Aeneas. The horses are yours. They will go better with the hand they know, if we have to run for it, after all. They may take fright and run wild and refuse to carry us out of the battle if they miss your voice. And then the man will leap on us and kill us both and drive off the horses himself. No, you must drive your own team, and I will face him with my spear." So they got in and went off at a gallop. Sthenelus saw them coming and called out clearly, "Diomedes, my dear old friend, here are two strong men hot upon you, a pair of invincibles, Pandarus, the crack bowman, you know, Lycaon's son, and Aeneas, whose father is Anchises, and his mother is Aphrodite herself. Here's the car, let us be off, and don't go storming about in front like this, or you may lose your life."
Diomedes said with a frown, "Don't talk of running away, for I will not listen to you. Shirking and lurking is not in my blood. I'm not a coward yet. I don't care to use a car. I will stay as I am and face them. Pallas Athene forbids me to fear. As for these two, their horses shall not save them both, if one does get away. And look here a minute, there is something else. If Athene vouchsafe to me, out of the riches of her grace, to kill them both, you leave our horses here and just hitch the rein over the handrail. Then be sure to make a dash for those horses of Aeneas and drive them safely away. You know that they come of that stock which Zeus